This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is made possible in part each Wednesday by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do, a better business relationship. By Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. By Fairpoint Communications, small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. By Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. And by the over 1,000 VBSR members. Here's noted Vermont author David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. My guest for the hour today is former Governor Phil Hoff, who last month celebrated his 90th birthday. On Election Day in 1962, Phil Hoff made history in Vermont. Hoff, a one-term state representative from Burlington, had just been elected governor. Before that night, Vermont was a one-party Republican state. No Democrat had been elected governor in 109 years. Politics in Vermont were forever changed at that moment. Under Governor Hoff, Vermont became a two-party state with an activist government willing to adopt social, political, and environmental reforms. Many view Hoff as the founder of progressive politics in Vermont. In a statement issued by Senators Leahy and Sanders last month on the occasion of his 90th birthday, they wrote, quote, "Phil Hoff was not only a breath of fresh air, but a gale force of change. Governor Hoff achieved sweeping political reforms in a state where not much had changed in decades," close quote. Just to underscore what Vermont was like before Governor Phil Hoff, for more than 100 years, the Republican Party dominated Vermont's politics, controlling both houses of the legislature and the governor's office. Even in the landslide presidential election of 1936, Vermont joined Maine as the only state that voted against President Roosevelt and his New Deal policies. When Hoff took office as the 73rd governor, the Vermont House of Representatives was still apportioned by town, meaning that Burlington, with a population of over 40,000, had the same representation as Stratton, with a population of 24. Hoff changed the apportionment in the legislature, eliminated the overseers of the poor, who were locally appointed officials responsible for poverty in their communities, and then had the state take over welfare in 1968. He tried to do the same with local education by pushing for stronger schools and fewer of them, which actually helped push the union school movement that became supervisory unions. Well, for the rest of this story, I turn to my guest, Governor Phil Hoff. Governor Hoff, welcome to the Vermont Conversation, and happy 90th birthday.
Well, thank you.
We're actually speaking to you from Governor Hoff's home in Shelburne. So take us back to before you were governor. What made you think, in a state that had not elected a Democratic governor in over a century, that you could win?
Well, I don't know that I really thought I could. In a sense, I sort of stumbled into being the Democratic candidate. Jack Spencer, who was chairman of the Democratic Party, was very anxious to get a person running on the Democratic ticket who was a Protestant and not Catholic, which I think is because I think most people would think that's kind of absurd today.
Yes.
But he was convinced that Democrats would produce a candidate who was Catholic, and that almost foreordained that they would lose. So he was very anxious to have me run, and so I did.
You know, it's been fascinating to read the accounts of politics in the 50s and 60s in Vermont, and there's a recently released book, When Red Turned to Blue, which is the story of your administration. And one of the things it describes is how the Burlington Free Press would not even send reporters to cover the Democratic conventions because, as the publisher wrote, he dismissed it as a loser's club that every 2 years would just trot out another candidate who would essentially hurl himself off a cliff. Was that your experience of Democratic politics in the 50s?
Yes and no. I sense even then that Vermont wanted some change. You can go back to the time of Ernest Gibson. Ernest Gibson ultimately became the United States federal judge for Vermont. But before that, he had been a sort of a war hero during World War II and came out and challenged the Prouty domination of Republican politics. And he was a liberal Republican, and he won. And he introduced some reforms, some of them I picked up. But so I had a sense that Vermont was on the verge of change, and indeed it was.
What was your secret to winning in 1962? Because I imagine there's some lessons there that modern-day candidates might benefit from. How does a long-shot candidate make himself viable in Vermont?
Well, first of all, I think the time was very helpful. People were ready for change. And I campaigned hard. I really did, up and down the state. Helped no end by my wife, who was in many ways a better campaigner than I was. So we, in a sense, stumbled into a period of time when Vermont was really interested in change. And we were the epitome of that. But mostly, my campaign was shaking hands with people, saying hello wherever I could, and getting people acquainted with me.
And reading the accounts of your campaign, you and your wife Joan, who's sitting alongside you here, were tireless. You're driving from Burlington to Brattleboro and Bennington, and often showing up where there might be only a few people in the meeting.
Yeah, well, you have to accept that as being a minority candidate.
How do you keep from just getting discouraged, you know, a 2-3 hour drive and you're looking at a handful of people?
I don't know that I ever became discouraged. Uneasy at times, considering all the hard work, and it was hard work. But I don't think at any time was I really discouraged.
Well, let's set the national scene. You know, at that time, John F. Kennedy had been elected president in 1960. In the course of your campaign, you were often compared favorably to Kennedy, and in the accounts I've read, you did nothing to discourage the comparison. You were quite happy with that.
Absolutely. It was a long time admirer of Kennedy.
Now, you took office in, I guess, January 1963.
Right.
John Kennedy is assassinated just 11 months later. How did that affect you?
I don't think it affected me politically at all. Because Vermont is tucked away in a small state in the nation. But it's depressing, because I was a big-time admirer of the Kennedys and the Kennedy family. And so it was a very depressing time.
Who was Jack Kennedy? You know, now he's a fixture of history. But you experienced him. You met him a number of times. Tell us a little bit what President John Kennedy, what he was like.
Well, it was absolutely charming. Of all the politicians I've met in my life, I'm saying clearly he was the most charming. He had something about him that just appealed to me and to others. He also clearly was progressive in his politics and and whatever he did. And in a way, he was a messenger of change also. And he did bring real change. Did I get to know him well? Not really. I don't know if you ever get to know. Well, I did get to know President Johnson rather well. But Jack Kennedy, he was not around too long. So I never had a chance to develop a very strong relationship, although after my election, Joe and I visited him in the White House at his request. And everything I had thought about him was absolutely true. He's one of the most charming people I ever hoped to meet.
My guest today on the Vermont Conversation is former Governor Phil Hoff, who turned 90 last month and is best known for being the first Democrat in over 100 years to be elected as governor in 1962 and having changed the face of politics in Vermont ever since. Take us back to election night in 1962. You were in Winooski, and you declared famously, "A century of bondage over." What did you mean by that?
Oh, well, I don't know how I came up with that. But, you know, if you take a look at Vermont, it was over 100 years since we elected a Democrat, and so we just automatically went Republican, and you almost felt as though you were just tied into that Republican majority. It was a form of bondage. I don't know how I came up with that night, but I did. I remember the election night at my home. My goodness. It was a very exciting time. Although I do remember some amusing things. My mother and father came up from Turner's Falls, Massachusetts, which is down below Brattleboro, but in Massachusetts. I had called and invited them to come up for the election, and I remember my father saying, "Gee, I don't know, that's a kind of long trip." He said, "Are you going to win?" And I said, "How the hell do I know, but I've got a shot at it." And one of the amusing things that happened, Bernard Leddy had been the candidate for governor before me.
2 years earlier.
And I'm convinced that when I ran, he would have won, but he was not about to go through that process again. But his wife was the mainstay of the, Johanna Leddy was the mainstay of the Democratic Party. And in my living room that night, I happened to overhear a conversation between Johanna and my mother. My mother said to Johanna at some point, "You know," she said, "a Massachusetts Republican is just like a Democrat in Vermont." I never could figure out how she came up with that, but she did.
So the administration you inherited was, the civil service was entirely Republican, and you once complained that you were the only Democrat in your administration. How did you get anything done?
Well, it's important to establish how I got it done, because it's important to understand that Vermont was not totally dominated by a conservative wing of the Republican Party. There were progressive Republicans, noteworthy Bill Billings, who I got to know very well. And he became only speaker. But he came from the Aiken, Gibson wing of there. So he was pretty progressive in his outlook. And I might say that before that, when I was in the legislature, we formed a group that met once a week to review pending legislation. That included, I think, three Democrats and four or five Republicans. But we became the very best of friends over time. And there was not a marked difference in outlook and philosophy. So one of the advantages I have is I came in with some people who were active in Republican, but active in state house politics, and they're very helpful.
And this was the group known as the Young Turks.
Right. Right.
So you set about to enact some very ambitious changes. When you came in as governor, what were you thinking were the main things that you hoped to change as governor?
Well, let me tell you the truth. I knew that I had been elected, but the chances of being reelected in a presidential year were somewhere between zero and none. So I think, well, if I'm going to spend it, I might as well go after the things I really believe in. And so I did, in the field of welfare, education, and so forth and so on. And some of it took. But you got to understand that while the legislature was Republican, there were significant elements of it that came out of the Gibson-Aiken wing of the Republican Party. And also because we knew each other well as Young Turks. So that was all very helpful.
I'm speaking with Governor Phil Hoff today on the Vermont Conversation. So one of the things that you did was to take a legislature that was, I believe it was 256 members, and shrink it and change the apportionment. Vermont was known to be one of the most malapportioned states. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, the representative from Burlington, which was you, with 40,000 residents, had the same voting power as the representative from towns with populations of 40 and 50. How did you get the legislature to vote to change its entire way of representation and shrink, lose 100 members?
Well, you've got to understand that the federal government, Supreme Court, had said that system just could not exist. And so we were forced to reapportion our legislature. And it became a struggle in the sense of what numbers would reduce to. I would like to have had a house of about 50 people, but I end up with 150, but that's far less than what it was before. And it had a marked influence on what we could do.
So it wasn't until the early 1960s that Vermont actually had one person, one vote in its legislature.
That's correct, and it's something that not so much we did as the federal Supreme Court had ordered it.
Just curious, you know, in the daily workings of the legislature prior to this reapportionment, how could a representative from a tiny town, you know, really feel that there was any fairness to the fact that they had the same voting power as you did, having been elected by the whole city of Burlington?
Well, I suppose it was part of the Republican domination. They just accepted it as a given and moved on.
Now, another one of the initiatives you took was to change the way schools worked.
Yeah.
Tell me about what was going on in education that you were trying to change.
Well, in my view, education in Vermont at that time was woefully inadequate. And the education system was run by, just as the legislature, one representative from each town. Each town established its own schools. And in my view, it was just totally inadequate. And so we went after it. And ultimately we brought about rather significant change. It took some time, but it happened.
Now, in the you know, the kind of misty view of history, it's all a series of great victories, but you actually suffered quite a few losses along the way to getting these things done. You were getting stonewalled and stymied at many turns as you tried to, for example, create a union school system. And what were some of the defeats you encountered?
Well, you know, you don't remember your defeats. I sure had them, but I think, you know, you accepted them and moved on. And I don't remember particularly, at this point in our conversation, the defeats, the significant defeats, but I never looked upon them as defeats. They were sort of lay the foundation for future change.
Was there a lot of resistance to changing? I mean, this debate, of course, is happening again now. It's really, the debate has never stopped, over the issue of schools and whether we should continue to have these small schools in small towns or consolidate into, you had the union school districts, now they're talking about further consolidation. What kind of resistance was there?
Oh, it's just like butting your head up against a stone wall. And, but we made progress. It took us time. Initial efforts, of course, were badly defeated. But with the changing tone of the legislature itself, we were able to make some significant progress.
Looking at one of the other items we mentioned was this idea of overseers of the poor. Could you explain what that was?
Well, in those days, each town was responsible for the poor in their community. And they established, they had an overseer of the poor in each town. And sometimes they created their own buildings to house them. And it was inhuman. A very poor way of dealing with it. And that's one of the things we went after. I mean, it was just wrong, morally and in every other way.
So communities would actually kind of warehouse people who were not, didn't have money, and what were you trying to create?
Oh, I wanted to create a society which one recognized that we had people in those circumstances that if we established programs, education, and otherwise, to raise them out of the depths and make them producers, and people proud of themselves.
And this, you were essentially talking about what we now know as the modern welfare system, where there would be some state support and people could still live independently.
Absolutely.
How long did it take to get something like that in Vermont?
Well, that's an interesting story in itself, but let me be brief about it. We had in the legislature a man, oh, God, what's his name, he ran circuses. Reed Lefebvre was his name. And he was, I would say, a moderate Republican. But he had always been head of the welfare, of the Finance Committee. But then, under Bill Billings, he ended up not having that job, and he ended up as head of welfare. So, our efforts to change him was directly at him, through the head of the old welfare thing for the state, by John Wackman.
Okay, we're going to have to pause there and come back after the news. My guest this week is Governor Philip Hoff. We'll be back after the news.
WDEV and McKenzie Country Classics are having a Welcome to Summer contest every Friday. Listen to Artie Levine's Getaway between 2 and 4 p.m. Call the WDEV contest line at 244-1777 when you hear the McKenzie Country Classics theme song.
Old John McKenzie was a dedicated man, made the best pork sausage in all the land. John told his boys both clear and loud, carry on the name and do me proud.
The prize is the ultimate grilling experience. To each of the following: a package of McKenzie natural casing franks, a package of all beef franks, McKenzie grilling kielbasa, McKenzie sweet Italian sausages, alfresco smoked and Dooley chicken sausage, and Chipotle chorizo chicken sausage.
Listen every Friday during Artie Levine's afternoon getaway for McKenzie's theme and be the third caller on the WDEV contest line at 244-1777.
Old John McKenzie was a dedicated man, made the best pork sausage in all the land. John told his boys both clear and loud, carry on the name and do me proud.
From WDEV and McKenzie Country Classics.
AP update, I'm Ed Donahue. Witnesses in Gaza say Israeli airstrikes in a crowded shopping area killed 16 people. The AP's Karen Laub is in Gaza City.
They say a first strike hit a metal workshop, and as fire trucks and medics and onlookers rushed to the scene, several more strikes hit the area. And it's in these follow-up strikes that health officials say at least 15 people were killed and more than 150 people were wounded.
The number of dead is now 16. Witnesses say the marketplace was crowded with shoppers because people thought a ceasefire was in place. It happened hours after Israeli shells slammed into a UN school sheltering displaced Palestinians. Another 15 people were killed there. This is UN Relief Agency spokesman Christopher Guinness.
This is an affront to all of us, a source of universal shame. Today, the world stands disgraced.
He's calling for an immediate ceasefire. AP update, I'm Ed Donahue.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility makes the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman available each Wednesday, along with People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow. Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. And Business Energy Action. Challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. As well as over 1,000 plus VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. My guest this week is former Governor Phil Hoff. Governor Hoff turned 90 last month, and we're talking about his time as governor of Vermont, elected in 1962. He served three terms. He was the first Democratic governor elected in over a century in Vermont, and is credited with ushering Vermont into the modern era of politics and two-party politics in the state of Vermont. You can join the conversation by calling 802-244-1777, or toll-free 877-291-8255. Governor Hoff, in the mid-1960s, you became increasingly involved in national politics. You were very concerned about and involved in civil rights, and you joined with New York City Mayor John Lindsay and co-founded the Vermont New York Youth Project, which brought minority students from the city together with Vermont students to work on joint summer projects at several Vermont colleges. According to the Boston Globe, the program, which temporarily doubled Vermont's black population, quote, uncovered some latent bigotry that had not been visible before. So tell me first, what was your idea with the Vermont New York Youth Project? What did you hope to accomplish with it?
Well, you understand at that time that there had been significant change nationally in terms of how we dealt with the people of color. And I happened to be in Washington when Jack Kennedy made a presentation to a relatively small group, but noted that it was really a crisis thing for us, and I accepted that as such. And I returned to Vermont convinced that we as Vermonters should do something along those lines. So I asked my staff to pull together all the major religious leaders in Vermont, and then I confronted them with the need to do something. And they agreed. So out of this came the Vermont New York Youth Project, which I did in conjunction with Mayor Lindsay. In itself, it was a successful program. In terms of its reception by Vermonters generally, it left something to be desired. Vermonters weren't really, as a whole, weren't as ready for this as I hoped they would be. So it impacted on me politically, but I still look back, and I'm still proud of what we did. It worked.
What worked?
Well, we brought significant numbers of black, essentially teenage kids in a variety of projects, most of them on college campuses, not all of them entirely. I think there have been many as five, but I'm not sure of that. And we then coupled them with our own white kids on a one-to-one basis. And it worked wonderfully. Well, they came from totally different worlds, knew nothing very much about each other or their world, but over the course of the summer, it worked out very well. But it was not well understood by Vermont public generally.
Why do you say that? How did Vermonters let you know that they were not fully in support of this?
By political results. And I don't remember the specific results, but they let me know.
Well, another national issue you involved yourself in was the Vietnam War. After President Kennedy's assassination, when President Johnson became president, you broke publicly with him and opposed the Vietnam War, and then also announced that you were backing the presidential candidacy of Robert F. Kennedy, who would, this was before Johnson announced he wasn't running. What made you decide to take a stand like that? You were the first Democratic governor to break with the Democratic president.
Well, there's a story behind this. I, with other national governors, had, it was an exchange program with governors of Japan. And so a group of us, I don't know how many, and never not, you know, maybe five or six, something like that. We're in Japan, and Johnson heard we were there, and he was always seeking help for his situation in Vietnam. So he arranged to have us flow into Vietnam. While there, I ran across a guy who was in intelligence who had Vermont roots, and the day that they were going to put us on a carrier, watch planes take off. I couldn't see much about that. So he arranged to have me picked up at 3 o'clock in the morning by an unmarked Jeep run by an unmarked driver. And I had asked John Chafee of Rhode Island to accompany me. And it was an amazing trip. But what, and I got to talk to village chiefs and so forth. And what I just discovered more than anything else is these towns just wish we could go away and leave them alone. Both sides. And I recognized that the war was a dead end. And so I opposed it.
It was was this trip when, around 1967 or so?
I assume so, but I'm not sure of that.
Yeah. Huh, so that really was the turning point for you, your own visit to Vietnam.
Yes, it was.
Did you talk to President Johnson about what you saw there?
Well, not directly, except one thing. I talked to his staff, and in fairness, I was going to break with him without letting him know, and so all sorts of things happened in attempts to prevent me from doing that, but I did it anyway. But
what did they do to try and prevent you from?
Oh, they were going to send the Secretary of State up to talk to me and all sorts of things. And of which I resisted. It wasn't going to do any good. And later on in that, a little hazy about a year now, but a Vermont Christmas tree was going to be the center of the White House lawn. So it was a real human interest story. The guy who had found it in England and nurtured it, and it was taken down to Washington. And I made arrangements to stop in and say hello to President Johnson. So I went in. It was really kind of a courtesy to call him.
This was December 1967.
I guess that's right.
Yes.
And of course, I finally looked at it and said, Mr. President, couldn't we give up the bombing of the nation next to Vietnam? And he turned on me and he gave me, as only he could, and he gave me 5 minutes worth, and then finally he stood up and I stood up and he said, why don't you go back to Vermont, take care of your affairs, and let us take care of ours. So that was the end of it. But I think that war was a mistake.
What gave you, as the governor of one of the smallest states in the country, the courage to stand up to President Johnson, who was no shrinking violet, as history has recorded?
that's for sure. Well, I had come to know President Johnson, and I liked him. I thought he was wrong on the Vietnam thing. But I liked him, and I got along with him the times that I saw him. I can't tell any more than that.
Yeah, yeah. You were briefly considered to be a vice presidential candidate for, I'm not sure if it was for Bobby Kennedy, or Gene McCarthy. What was the story there?
Well, the progressives at that convention were really anxious to field somebody who was a progressive on the national ticket. And some people came after me, but after talking to my friends after a while, I said, I'm not in for that.
So you served 3 terms. I believe you were the first Vermont governor to serve 3 terms.
Well, it might have been.
This was a job that typically people did for 2 to 4 years and moved on. So you served 3 terms. So in 1966, your third term, Democrats took most of the statewide offices. In 1968, now you're not running again, Dean Davis is elected. He's a Republican. Republicans won all the statewide offices. So in 2 years, you have a complete flip in state government. What happened?
Oh, I think a couple of things. One was the program to bring colored people up to Vermont, a couple of their own, and attempt to deal with that problem. I don't think that was well accepted. My position on the war was not very helpful. There are perhaps other things.
You then re-entered politics in 1970 and ran against the incumbent junior senator from Vermont, Winston Proudy. You lost badly in that election.
I sure did.
What went wrong for you?
Well, because I had lost touch with the Vermont people. That's the size of it. The things that I talked about that reacted not well with people of Vermont, such as bringing those kids from New York City and coupling them with our own. We'd had a very bad situation in the northern part of Vermont involving a black preacher that did not go well. I just lost touch, let's face it.
You felt you had gotten out too far ahead of your constituents?
Yes, it was. They said so.
How did that affect you to have such a big public loss like that?
First of all, I wasn't surprised. How did it affect you? Well, you accept it. Move on.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking this week on the Vermont Conversation with former Governor Phil Hoff, who celebrated his 90th birthday a month ago. We're talking about his time as the first Democratic governor of Vermont in over a century and the political years that followed. One of the things that came out in your race against Winston Prouty was that you announced shortly afterward about your struggles with alcoholism. What made you decide to talk publicly about that?
Well, you know, alcoholism and my drinking played a big part in my loss to Winston Prouty. And
how so?
Because people came to know that I was over drinking. It was painfully evident. And so all of me, I knew I had to come to grips with it, and I did.
This is not an easy thing to come to grips with or to get over. How were you able to recover from alcoholism?
In the end, it was my saying to myself, that's the end. Just stop, and I did. Of course, I had the help of a very devoted wife and some others, but in the end, it was me saying, that's enough, it's it.
Do you have any second thoughts about your decision to go public with this?
No. My overdrinking was publicly known anyway, so I figured I had to broach it publicly as well.
Did you hear from others that your example made any sort of difference for them?
The only way to answer that is I hope so. But, yeah, there have been some isolated cases of people saying that my quitting helped them come to grips with their alcoholism, but I don't think it was a big thing.
Yeah. And when you quit drinking in the early 70s, was that it?
I haven't dropped since.
Well, we're talking almost 50 years ago. So, in 1983, you returned to the State House to serve 3 terms as a state senator from Chittenden County. What made you decide to come back?
Mostly because I think public service is in my blood, and I thought I could be helpful. And in a way, I think I was.
How so?
Well, I played an influence in legislation that passed and didn't pass, and that was considered and not considered and so forth. So I did play a role in that sense, but I was not a major figure in any sense. But it was good for me in the sense of the aftermath of my drinking.
You entered politics at a time when Vermont was a one-party state, a one-party Republican state. Fast forward to today, 2014, we are a one-party state again, with the Democrats controlling the legislature and the governorship. What advice do you have for the current leaders of the state about that situation?
Just go ahead and do what you think is right. Address the major problems that we need to face here in the state of Vermont. Don't worry about election and re-election. Just do the right thing.
What legacy are you proudest of your own?
Oh, a legacy of change. And I was. A variety of things, anywhere from reapportionment to you name it. But, yeah, I was a messenger of change in a major way.
You've mentioned that your civil rights advocacy cost you politically. So with the wisdom of years and some distance from that time, would you be as strong an advocate of civil rights again today if you knew now what you knew then?
Absolutely. I mean, it is the very essence of our society. I feel very strongly about it.
What else do you wish you did in your time running the state?
I don't know that I can really answer that. We went after about anything that we felt was important. And we went after a hell of a lot of things. And that's the way I'm built. You know, that's who I'm about.
As somebody who entered politics, taking on a task that most thought was unwinnable and undoable, what advice do you have to Vermont politicians who are facing great odds themselves, entering races or taking on issues that they're given very little chance of winning?
My advice is you decide what you think is right and adhere to it and follow it and fight for it. And you may win, you may lose, but it's important that you stand up for the things that are important and that you believe in.
Looking at some of the people who followed you as governor, Governor Kunin, Governor Snelling, Governor Douglas, Governor Shumlin, Governor Dean, I'm sure I'm missing quite a few along the way, that spans many years. Who stands out as somebody who was most like you, trying to make a big impact?
Of those people, Madeline Kunin would have been one. Our dean another. Dick Snelling was very interesting guy. I admired him.
He ran against you and lost.
Yes, that's right.
What did you admire about him?
He was progressive in his views, and he wasn't afraid to express them. And he was very strong in his opinions, and he stood up for them, and I admired that. He was a good man.
What's your view of national politics today? You know, we have total gridlock in Congress, leadership that won't speak to one another in Washington. How do you get things done? How do you break through that?
I'm not sure I have an answer for that. You know, we are very well represented in Congress. We have very good senators and a very good congressman. They have all indicated a willingness to talk to other people from the other side. They stand for the right things. But the big problem is that in days past, only Democrats and Republicans would get together on the essential things to move forward, and that's not happening. But if left to the people who had in Congress, it would.
What's your view of President Obama?
I like him. He's had a tough row, and you have a tough campaign. But by and large, I think he's stood for the right things.
And Governor Shumlin, our current governor, how do you think
he's doing?
I think
he's been a good governor. I really do. And I think his attempt to bring universal health care to Vermont is laudable and hoping to ultimately succeed.
Do you think it will be successful? That's a very ambitious goal.
I'm not close enough to the politics of Vermont to answer that, but I sure hope so. I think it's badly needed.
Have you given any advice to any current political leaders in Vermont about a way to do what they do and get things done?
No, not at all. I'm out of it totally.
What have you enjoyed most in your post-political life?
Reading and doing things we want to do. We have a place for the summer in Maine, and we go to Las Cruces, New Mexico in the winter, where we've met lots of good friends, and so it works very well.
Mm. Well, as somebody who's straddled both the national and the local scene, what do you think sets Vermont apart? It continues to be a very unique state, politically and otherwise. What is your insight on what makes it different?
Because of that, Vermonters are by nature independent, and they stood for that over the years, and I hope it will continue.
Okay. Well, Governor Philip Hoff, I want to thank you for sharing your thoughts with us today on the Vermont Conversation, and again, happy 90th birthday.
Well, thank you. I hope some good comes out of this conversation.
I'm sure it will. That'll do it for this week's Vermont Conversation. You can hear this show and all other past shows at VermontConversation.com. We'll be back next week on the Vermont Conversation, Wednesday at 1, here on WDEV.
Been listening to the Vermont Conversation with host David Goodman. Tune in next Wednesday when once again Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and its over 1,000 VBSR members, along with Fairpoint Communications, small business owners make it big with Fairpoint, National Life Insurance for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow, People's United Bank, find out what know-how can do, and Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to patient, community, and medicine since 1879, as well as Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. These all help to bring you David Goodman with this special program.
On the way, world and national news update on locally owned and operated 96.1 WDEV FM in Warren, FM 96.5 in Barrie, AM 550 WDEV, Waterbury, Montpelier, and serving the kingdom at FM 101.9 from Island Pond. We'll have the getaway, 2 hours of music on the way as well. Following world and national news update right now.
I'm Ed Donahue, the U.S.